Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter. At 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Women's Equality Day was Sunday, August 26th, 2 days ago. But the many issues at its foundation are ever present. And tonight, we're going to talk about the genesis of Women's Equality Day, where the issues are, and where they're going. All of my guests are examples of some of the brightest minds Howard University has to offer. They are Dr. Valethia Watkins, Director of the Women's Studies Graduate Certificate Program and Associate Professor of Afro-American Studies, Dr. Gina Brown, Dean of the College of Nursing and Allied Health Sciences, and Dr. Sandra Edmonds Crew, Dean of the School of Social Work. Lines are open if you have a comment or a question about Women's Equality Day at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Ladies, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Watkins, you're up first. What is the genesis of Women's Equality Day? How did it start?
Congress established Women's Equality Day in 1973, and they selected August 26th in commemoration of the passage of the 19th Amendment, which passed or was ratified on August 26, 1920. So it was designed to pay homage to the women's suffrage movement and to celebrate women gaining the right to vote. However, it's important to note that people start off by saying, just think about it, 100 years ago, women could not vote. But the reality is for African women, African American women, less than 55 years ago, Black women could not vote. So we did not gain the right to vote until the Voter Rights Act of 1965. So what this day invites us to do is really look at the fact that women are not a monolithic group, and we cannot romanticize the political relationships between women, because if we looked at that movement, we realized that in many ways, the women's suffrage movement discriminated against Black women and betrayed Black women.
Well, Dr. Crew, it started talking about the vote, but equality for women, particularly women of color, it's so broad and so deep. When you think about the phrase Women's Equality Day, what comes to mind for you? Is it the vote or is it something else?
Thank you so much, Harold. I appreciate it. What I think about is the economic disparities and the workplace disparities that are out there as we're thinking about women in the workplace. And if we think about it being almost 100 years, and there's still this pay equity issue that we're facing, that women generally earn 75 cents on the dollar of the male. So although we have really come a long way, we still have a long way to go. So I think it's what I think about also is in workplace, the whole caregiving responsibilities. As we start thinking about caregiving, and women are responsible for caregiving at the beginning of life and at the end of life. So our career trajectories are impacted by our caregiving roles. So I think that has a lot to do with the pay equity issues as well. Because if I have to stay out of the workplace to have a child, and then I return to the workplace, and then if there's an issue with health care, child care, aging parents, my mother had Alzheimer's, although men have stepped up to the plate, and I am so happy about that, mostly women are carrying out the caregiver responsibilities of society. So that has a lot to do with women's equality, their ability to earn income, to keep them in the workplace. So I think equity, if you can't just make it equal, because I didn't have a level playing field. So equality assumes that there's a level playing field. Equity assumes that you're going to give me what I need to be successful. So when I think about this day of commemoration, of celebration, I think about us paying attention to women in the workforce and those lower socioeconomic women who are struggling and juggling means. So,
well, Dr. Brown, is Women's Equality Day a day to celebrate or to consider?
I think it's both. I think it's both in the sense that you have to really consider where we've come from. It's only been 53 years, as my colleague said, that we've been able to vote. But in those 53 years, what else has occurred? Our health disparities have increased, with cardiovascular disease being number one, the number one illness for African-American women, second to breast cancer for African-American women, us worrying about sickle cell, the components of health disparities and how those relate to illnesses, diabetes and hypertension and all of the things that we as a community, African-American, all of those things tie into what Dean Crew said in terms of the socioeconomic components, with our black men being one out of five men being in prison. All those things reflect upon our health disparities. And so really, it's a day to reflect, but it's also a day to look at where we've come from. You don't know where you're going until you look at where you've been. And so we need to look at where we've been, look at where we need to get to, and then put next steps in place in order to make sure that we do better the next 53 years.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about Women's Equality Day. We're talking about women's equity from all areas of existence here in America. If you have a question, if you have a comment, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tamathia, help me with that. Is that right? Tamathia? Did I get that right?
Tamathia
from Baltimore. Go right ahead. What's on your mind?
First, thank you for such a wonderful topic.
Sure.
And thank your guests for what they've said so far. I would agree with what's been said just in terms of the equity and salary. And what I'd like to ask someone on the panel to respond to is, how do we deal with the disparities that also show up in retirement?
What do you mean by that when you say disparities that show up in retirement? Explain that briefly, if you can, please. Can you hear me?
What I mean is, you made the point that...
Turn your radio down, please. Turn your radio down. Please go right ahead.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, what happens to you in younger life hitchhikes with you to older age. So if you have pay disparities in younger life, that's going to follow you to your retirement age as well. So, if whatever, discrimination is faced then carries with you. So if you have to take time out for childbearing or child care, then your pay is going, your retirement earnings are going to be different. So as a gerontologist, I often see this, or women who enter the workforce later in life after their children have become adults. So now they're able to enter the workforce. Well, they only have 20 years, perhaps. So I think that's what the caller is talking about. So we really do have to do a better job of retirement literacy at early stages for women, so that we understand what happens in younger age really does hitchhike with you to older age.
But I have a question about that, because if there is a pay equity issue for younger women when compared to their male counterparts, how much does retirement And by extension, financial literacy help them if they are still making less? That sounds to me that they must, once again,
you're playing catch up,
overcompensate for the sexism, the
Absolutely.
Discrimination, the financial discrimination. Is there another choice?
You're playing catch up, and it happened to me when I had my children. I worked part time. until they went to school at the age of six. Well, five to kindergarten, six. And so what I had to do was meet with a financial planner, which I couldn't really afford at that time because I was already making less as a nurse at that time. But I really had to put some priorities in place to say, I'm going to meet with the financial planner. I'm going to spend this additional money in order to make sure that in 20 years I'm catching up because I've already lost 5 to 7 years from being home part time with these children. So most of us as African Americans do not look at financial planning and do not look at financial literacy when we're working through those things. We look at moving, as Dr. Watkins said before, paycheck to paycheck. So for us to move in a different direction to start thinking outside of the box, we think about leaving money for our families, but we don't think about wealth building. As African Americans, most of us don't think about wealth building. We think about leaving money. And so if we leave $20,000, $20,000 or $100,000 or even best case scenario, $500,000, we think we've done something well, and we have, but that's not wealth building. So we have to start thinking outside of the box to think about long-term planning. The Bible says that a wise person leaves money to their children's children. You're leaving an inheritance. So we have to think outside of the box to think about what else are we leaving our children. We're leaving, make sure that we don't leave health disparities. How do we do that? By taking care of ourselves in terms of our health, by making sure that the legacies that we leave with hypertension, with diabetes, that we're eating well, that we're exercising well, that we do those things that we actually need to do in order to leave those legacies. Because as Dean Crew has said, you're going to leave whatever you're dealing with as a young person. It's just going to exacerbate itself as you get older.
Well, thank you so much, Tamathia, for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about Women's Equality Day and where the issues are and where they are going. Dr. Watkins, let's talk a little politics. It was said during the era of Barack Obama that white women were big contributors to his win. Fast forward, the most recent special election in Alabama, Democratic Senator Doug Jones, it was said that not black men, not white women, but black women were responsible for his victory. What is happening politically right now, even beyond the Doug Jones situation?
Well, the importance of this moment, it allows us to see that women are not, have never been a single voting bloc. That there's, when they talk about a gender gap in voting, it is primarily between white men and white women, and not black men and black women. So it was the collective black vote that led to Doug Jones' victory. So even among white women, the majority have been voting Republican. Married white women have been voting Republican since the 70s. And so when we look at even today with the current occupant of the White House, the majority of white women put him in office despite his deplorable track record relative to misogyny and to gender. So I would say that even with Barack Obama, he did not win a majority. Democrats haven't won a majority white vote. And it depends on the demographics of the women. College women voted one way. And then working class women voted another way. So we have to look at I guess that's why I go back to that original point. We can't think of women as a monolithic group. And with regards to black women and our equality, our destiny is not, you cannot separate it from the conditions and status of our community in totality.
But black women aren't just showing up at the polls. They're showing up at the election offices.
Absolutely.
They're running. Yeah,
look at Prince George's County, what just occurred with the primaries.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. For example, you're talking about Angela also.
Correct.
We have, in Baltimore City, for example, we have had three black female mayors. We have in Georgia, you know, the possibility for the very first time in history that a black woman could be governor of Georgia. Not only governor of Georgia, but the first black female governor. Talk to me a little bit about that kind of civic engagement by black women?
Well, certainly a lot of people are stepping up to the plate as a part of the resistance. A lot of people are seeing the current occupant as saying, well, we're qualified, too, to make a difference, that this system has been rigged. It is not responsive to people's need. And so a lot of people feel free to step up to the plate and to begin to answer the call of leadership. And that was part of the mandate given about resistance. From the top to the bottom, you have Republicans running not only the White House, the Congress, the Supreme Court, the state legislatures, the governorship. And so people are seeing local politics as very important to empowering their communities.
Let me stop you there. I'm going to let you finish your point. I've got to take a break and let our listeners know that the lines are still open. Judith, calling from D.C., we're going to talk to you after the break. Also, if you have a comment, if you have a question, we're talking about Women's Equality Day and all of the issues that have to do with women, political equity, whether it's in the voting booth, on the job. Can we talk about home? Is that an issue?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. We need to talk about that, too. Stay with us. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. If you're on the phone, stay with us. You will be able to hear the program. Do not hang up. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR. More of this conversation in just a few seconds.
The Howard University Radio WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, Sirius XM Channel 142, HBCU and Sirius XM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking about Women's Equality Day and the issues. My guests are Dr. Valethia Watkins, Director of Women's Studies Graduate Certificate Program and Associate Professor of Afro-American Studies here at Howard University, Dr. Gina Brown, Dean of the College of Nursing and Allied Health Sciences, also at Howard, and Dr. Sandra Edmonds Crew, Dean of the School of Social Work here at Howard University. Dr. Watkins, we were talking about political engagement and women in 2018. Please finish your point.
I would just say that the challenge has been the money that's in the system and court rulings like Citizens United. And with the models that Bernie Sanders of small donor donations, people need money in this rigged system to run for office. And I think that's been a barrier. So I think people are seeing possibilities with the win of Alexander Ocasio-Cortez in New York. The possibility of people working together to make collective change that can happen. But I think on the flip side of running, and I think that's critically important, for too long we have reduced political participation to just voting.
Correct.
And that's important, but it's also important to be at the table, to be a decision maker, not just selecting a representative, but to be the representative. So the bigger challenge that we have as we celebrate Women's Equality Day is the systematic effort to disenfranchise.
Dr. Crew, I heard a really deep sigh from you. What was the thought behind that?
Well, you know, I was thinking, for women to be successful, there need to be mentors so that they know exactly what the rules are, not just the spoken rules, but they're always unspoken rules. And I was really thinking about our alum from the School of Social Work who is running for the state senate in the state of Maryland. And so Melody Gee Griffith really speaks about the importance of having mentorship so that you're really playing in a different club. So even though it's not just about getting elected, it's about being effective when you get there to be able to speak to women's rights and the needs of women there. So you really need a base that's going to make you successful, not just getting you in the door. So I think that mentorship is really important. And I recall a sage statement that if you educate a woman, you educate a community. And so I think we're going to have to rely upon others who have experiences. The late Congressman Ron Dellums was very supportive of women. He considered himself a feminist and was an early supporter of Shirley Chisholm for her presidency. So we really have to educate men how to support women.
Well said. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Judith, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Judith. What's on your mind?
Well, I want to encourage my professional sisters to look to the unions. I'm in Local 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and we have income equality in our contracts. We also fight for full educational benefits. So you may have a cleaning job or a cafeteria job with us on one of our contracts. You get to go to school. You could take anything from IT to becoming a plumber or building engineer or to, you know, study mathematics, go on to build the classes you need to then go on and get a greater degree. Paid family leave. These are issues that we come to the table about, but I also want to urge those who are elected, females that are elected, don't just come to the unions and to the community for votes and for money. Let us know when the hearings are being held around the issues that you need our support on.
Okay.
Because you have to learn the system up there where you're going in the legislature, but you also need us to be observing when the issues come to the floor.
Judith, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Anybody want to comment on what Judith
I'll
was
saying? I'll comment in the fact that I think she's absolutely correct, that there is a place for the unions and for what it does in terms of equality for not just our females, but for our males, and particularly for people of color. I want to also just kind of chime in and add in that policy, not just running for office, but being at the table to create policy, be that grassroots, and people say from the ground up, but that's actually the top, being the one to actually develop that policy through fellowships, through volunteering, through all of the other components that it takes in order to make a difference, really is what takes off and what makes a difference in terms of having equality for our women.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Roxanne, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Roxanne. What's on your mind?
I just want to say for the record that I've been a single mom since I was 15 years old, and I raised my children in a rural area in Wellington Park, Washington, D.C., Elvins Road, Washington, D.C. There has been a change in a politician, so forth, as my friend running for office of delegate as Dion Ryder, running for Board of Electors of D.C. Councilman at Large. I want to say to the world that you can make a change and make a difference. I'm a single mom since I was 15 years old, and I raised four young men by myself since I was 15 years old, and none of them have been arrested, and all of them have high school diplomas, but you have a stigma, and a stigma in D.C. that young men can't make it, but with my saying that I raised my children by myself and all of them being men, is a strong politician and woman that's running for
Roxanne, we are not going to do political ads on this show. I let you say it once. I'm going to let you finish your point. What's your point?
As far as saving money and raising children by yourself, you can't save money as well as trying to be a single mom. Just trying to say to myself, to others, that you can do it as well as trying to do your thing and raise your children by yourself.
Okay, I'll let you stop there. Anybody want to comment on that? Because I think while being a single mother, it is laudable, it's not new. It happens. And we should praise them. But the reality is that it's a reality. And thoughts?
Well, single parenthood, being a single mom, creates special challenges. And so certainly, Roxanne, I applaud you for the work that you've done. But as I think, as we as I mentioned, the whole caregiver responsibilities. When you're a single mom, you don't have that other person in the home. So you are really responsible for more than the dual-headed household. So I think it's critically important for us to have policies. The earlier caller talked about paid leave. So it's important that we advocate, our politicians advocate for paid leave, and so that would be very helpful to single mothers doing that. But I think the issues with being a woman has to do with not only being a single mom, but all mothers have special situations that they have to cope with, and they're just exacerbated when you're a single mother.
Mm-hmm. And I think we need to reflect on and return to some of our old-fashioned values of collectivism and community. African proverb, it takes a village. And so what we can do is step up as a community and provide support to single mothers. Again, I applaud Roxanne for the tremendous job that she has done. But no one gets there alone. And so if we can help out those who are better off, those who are in church, those who are in organizations, to provide support in whatever way we can, these are things we can do without money. So we have to do, we have to operate on multiple tracks at the same time. Like you said, it's been done, it's been around since forever, but in the olden days we had, or in the past, not the olden days.
Come on with it. That's
in
all right.
In the past, right. You know, people, our community, we had stronger community. We had stronger institutions that supported these mothers. So even though they were a single parent, you had aunts and uncles and multi-generational households that provided the other assistance that people needed. And so these are things we need to reconsider and return to.
Yeah, but I think we have to also think about the mobility patterns.
What do you mean by that?
So when we were growing up, it perhaps aunts and uncles and cousins lived close by, but as we have geographical mobility, those relatives may not be there. So Dr. Watkins is exactly correct. We have to build other support systems. So it doesn't mean that we have to go without the support, but they have to be support systems that are coming from different areas. We talked about faith-based support already. It may be a group of moms in school, and they're supporting each other. So we have to find new networks of support, because no one can raise children alone. I firmly believe it takes others to support you in doing that.
And while I would say it does take others, I lived it. My parents divorced when I was 7, and my mother had 5 children. She was going back to school as a college student, and my brother and I both sat in the back of many classes at Norfolk State University, which was Norfolk State College at that time, because my mother needed to take her youngest 2 children to school with her at night because she worked during the day. We experienced, after my parents' divorce, Medicaid. We experienced food stamps. We experienced having relatives who were nearby but not necessarily helpful. Our community was more of the church than anything else, but my mother raised those 5 children, having to go back to school and do what she needed to do, and all 5 of us went to college. All 5 of us finished college, and the four of the 5 of us have graduate degrees. It can be done. As you said, it's not new. Is it difficult? Yes. Does family close by? We had an aunt who lived walking distance. Doesn't necessarily make a difference, depending on what's going on and the logistics of the family and the dynamics. But people do it. You do what you have to do. And, you know, she figured out how to do it. She figured out how to go to school. Probably the reason my brother and I are both in education is because we sat in so many of those classrooms. So, again,
I was going to say, did you learn anything? Yeah, there it is.
We learned a whole lot at Norfolk State when we weren't students, and we learned a lot at funerals because she could play the piano. And so she played the piano at many funerals for Gray's Funeral Home, and we went to more dead bodies at the age of 7 through 12 until she remarried than anybody wants to say. I could tell you every hymn, every whatever, because we went to, because she made $25 for playing for those funerals. And so my first job was at a funeral home at 14, vacuuming beside caskets, because I had been in that environment. So you learn to do what you have to do. Women do it. We've been doing it. We continue to do it. It's what we do. But in looking at that, we can't forget that among African American men, among white men, among white women, we are still the lowest paid of that four component piece that's there, even in 2018.
And that brings me to something that I wanted to discuss, because Dr. Cruz said something that struck me earlier, and you may or may not be familiar with the Salesforce story that happened about a year or so ago, where the CEO, after it was brought to his attention, a man, it was brought to his attention that the women in his top positions were making significantly less than the men with the same titles and the same responsibilities. And he took $3 million to bring the women's salaries up to the level of the men. This brings to mind two things. The first thing is, and this refers to what Dr. Cruz said, you have to educate the men. You really do. Mm-hmm. But the second thing is, if a woman brings that to the attention of a man in power, how can a black woman speak truth to power without stepping over the line of stereotype, angry black woman? I want you all to answer that. Think about that on the other side of this conversation. I'm going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about Women's Equality Day and all of the issues having to do with that. We'll be back in just a moment. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking about Women's Equity Day and the issues that come with it. Before the break, we were talking about that Salesforce example where the CEO brought many women's salaries up to the level of men who were doing the same kind of work. And I was asking, and I will start with you, Dr. Crew, but anyone certainly welcome to jump in. How can a black woman speak that kind of truth to power, government, private industry, education, when they see something that is unbalanced without the stereotype of the angry black woman?
Okay. I think we arm ourselves with facts. So when you present from facts, then you can really focus on what the issue is. My pay is this and his pay is that. But when anger gets into the picture, you distort the facts. So it's really important also to be able to differentiate between conscious and unconscious bias. And that show that you were talking about, sometimes it happens, it's so much a part of the structure that you're not realizing you're being discriminatory, because the structure has always been that way, that this person gets a higher bonus than that person. And so you're just following a routine that has already been there. But I think what strikes me, I was listening to Hidden Figures. I was listening to a commercial talking about that. We train people not to talk about their salaries. Those are the hidden figures. So when you do that, it's personal information, then you are protecting your bias, because I am strictly focused on what I'm getting paid. And if I'm comparing myself with my sister friends and they're still getting underpaid, I don't always know that I'm being underpaid. So when we sort of don't have an opportunity to have transparency with pay, this is really a breeding ground for this equity situation. So I think that's where that mentorship helps, that I can go to someone outside maybe the arena and say, you know, Dr. Brown or Dr. Watkins, I'm facing sort of this. What would you recommend that I do in this situation? Because there's some woman out there who's faced the same thing that you have. So I think that's critically important, to find someone that you can talk about. How do I approach equity and pay?
Dr. Watkins, same thing. Your thoughts?
That's why, you know, collective bargaining union, it's about level playing field in the negotiation. And a lot of times at the individual, depending on your circumstances, if you, make certain demands, if it's in a place where it's a right to work situation, you may lose your job. So sometimes people who are in a stronger position and could take it or leave it are more empowered to make these kind of demands. So I think Dr. Crew is absolutely right. What maintains this system is the lack of transparency, the fact that, so we do need to talk salaries. They need to be published. That's the only way people will know what is taking place. And we also have to understand the structural reasons why this is the way it is, because this system has always thrived on cheap labor and exploiting workers. Mm-hmm. So it is a reflection of the value system of the society. It's not about being just or fair. It's about trying to lowball people if you could have them making nothing.
But not a,
which
but,
is the but, history of our experience in
but,
this country.
But let's also be realistic and honest that not every black woman in this country is a low wage earner. There are women in this country that are making six figures. Shoot, there are women in this city who are making six figures. They're making a lot of money, but mm-hmm. equity is still an issue. And to the point of the Salesforce example that I used. How can black women specifically level the playing field? And not just about the whole angry black woman thing, but more holistically, more broadly.
But if I can jump in, I found that an absolutely fascinating story because someone came to him and they commissioned a story. But even though he was trying to bring equity, he was willing to invest in the money. If you go back and look at this story, I'm looking at the table. There are no African people, no black people.
That's true.
It was completely all white. It was a conversation between white men and white women. So even in bringing about equity, they were not even thinking about, we don't have any diversity. We don't have any people of color. So it becomes an internal conversation about people in power. And that wealth is taken home to a white family that is concentrating the wealth within their community. So that is another dimension that puts us at a disadvantage individually as black women and collectively as black people.
Right. I don't think it's the six-figure component that's as much an issue, because you can look around the table and have six figures. It's about where the equity actually is. You give six figures to another white woman, to another white male, but you don't have anybody who has color that's working in your organization. Is that not an equity issue? So it's not about the money as much as it is about the equity in terms of adding us into the equation, making sure that we are a part of the equation, making sure that we have a seat at the table, making sure that we have decision-making rights and capabilities and power. In the conversation, nobody of color.
But my point was, and I agree, but my point was, when you have black women that are there, okay, how do they address this issue broadly? And I'm not talking about the one black woman at the mm-hmm. table. I'm talking about the one black woman at this table and the one black woman at the other table and the one black woman who is the head nurse but needs to speak about equity issues and not just money but treatment to doctors.
Correct.
What are the next steps beyond where we were and where we are to address these issues?
One of the things I think is that we do have to have more mentoring of individuals who've been in that space. One of the things I do in social work is I talk with my graduating students about how do you negotiate salary. So how do you know how to negotiate something if you've never had to negotiate something? So if you're if you're in a field where people simply say to you, and social work and nursing too, we're gendered professions, meaning mostly women occupy those roles. So if you're in gendered professions, you have to know what you can negotiate and what is negotiable and what is not negotiable. And so that privilege and that power structure even makes it worse. But still, we can prepare people for the strategies that are used in the job market. We know what they are. And so we need to disclose some of those things that have happened to us during our career and to say, hey, you need to watch out for that.
But don't black women need to, and black families, but in this particular conversation, black women need to look at the culture of what you just said, because based on what
you know, Dr. Brown said, you know, with, you know, mama playing piano and doing all of these other things, I can guarantee you, your mother said, we have to make do.
And we did.
But the problem with that, because my mother said it, my father said it, we black families say, because of our history, we have to make do. But then when we graduate from the Howard Universities and Norfolk States and the Morgan State Universities or wherever. wherever, and then we go in and we go into those rooms and we start talking about salary, we start talking about equity, when you've got mama and daddy whispering in your ear, make do.
Just
get the job.
Publish results. Results. So I'll give you an example in nursing and in most academic circles. You have journals that come out every year that give you the published range of salary. It gives you the low end of the salary, the median end of the salary, and the high end of the salary. So I can go back to my desk and look in this book and say, based on my years of experience, based on my education, Howard University should be paying me this. Now, when Howard University doesn't pay me this, that's between the minimum, the medium, and the mode, then it's up to me to go back to the provost or the president and say, hey, let me negotiate this or whatever, or start to look outside of that box. But the glass ceiling is still there. It's still, if there are 13 deans at Howard, I could not tell you what the other 12 make. Dean Crew and I have been colleagues for 3 years. We don't know what each other makes as females or as males or as our counterparts. So there's still that very closed environment where you don't discuss those things. And it's still a way, even though those components are published, we don't necessarily look at those because it's a scale that we may not necessarily be able to reach.
So right, and certainly collectively, if you look at the entire professorate at HBCUs, mm-hmm. particularly Howard, and compared it to what's going on at Georgetown, you see a total disparity. So, and we have to also be aware when women are in power that we also promote and show equity, because sometimes we're making decisions about people's salary who are women, and we're lowballing them.
Absolutely.
And so we have a responsibility to do right by other women and other people in our community. And we sometimes have the same value system of other people who are in decision-making powers, positions over people's economic life.
So I'm just so grateful that I had a mother who always taught us, you don't just need to survive, you need to thrive. Mm-hmm. So my experience and what that tells me is we need to start working with the girls when they're little to give them the understanding that you don't just go for survival, you go going for thriving. Mm-hmm. And so that was my background when I was always told, oh, well, you are. It was never a question whether or not I should earn the same.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the glass ceiling or the boardroom, should black women, in order to achieve the equality and the equity, should they kick down the door? Should they shatter it? Or should they slide under the door?
I think you should use your educational components to get where you need to get to. And I will say that because I have a 26-year-old daughter who graduated from law school last year, who landed a 6-figure job coming out the gate with no experience. It took me 10,000 years to earn 6 figures. She came out the gate at 20.
Day over 7,000.
Listen. It took me 20, you know, all these years, and she came out the gate, no experience, 6 figures, because she knew how to negotiate. She knew what her worth was. She wouldn't take less than her worth. These millennials are in a whole nother mindset than we're actually in. And so you look at, you teach them, you groom them to say, this is my worth, this is my value, this is what I'm worth, this is what everybody else is making, regardless to whether they're white, black, pink, or purple, and this is what I'm going to take. And then you give them a background so that if they don't land that job initially, they can come home or they can live off of what you've given them in terms of wealth. We didn't have that. When we got out of college, it was time to go.
Yeah, get on out.
Get out. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200.
And,
bye.
And sometimes it's quality of life issues. Yeah. I was at a position where it was a union teaching position. The salary was astounding when they told me. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Given my experience and background. And they were like, that's not enough. I was like, what? I've been at HBCU.
I got to stop you there. I am completely out of time, but I'm so glad to meet you ladies and to have you come down, and certainly looking forward to another conversation just like this. So thank you again, Dr. Felicia Watkins, Dr. Gina Brown, and Dr. Sandra Edmonds-Crew. I appreciate you coming down.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, August 28th. I'm Harold Fisher. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.